A little while back, I was in a bookstore and I spotted a title that caught my attention. Outpatients, The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism by Sasha Eisenberg. It's about the distances people travel for healthcare with a focus on destination dentistry in Hungary. The whole concept was something I'd never thought of as tourism, even though I've known people, lots of people, who have traveled to specific places that are known for specific procedures. This isn't just about other places, though. Kansas and Missouri hospitals are becoming destinations for certain kinds of procedures, too. We'll get to that. But first, I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're about to talk to the author of that book, Sasha Eisenberg. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So what is medical tourism? How would you succinctly define it just to get us started?
Yeah, it may sound a little more fun and carefree than it is, but any time that somebody is traveling, certainly across an international border for medical care, I think we would call that medical tourism.
That's pretty succinct.
Yeah, I mean, versions of this are happening everywhere. You know, basically you could come up with sort of any set of points of origin and any set of destination, but at its core, it's about people traveling for care.
Could you just list off a few examples of who goes where for what? You do that in your introduction, and I remember just like that day that I found this book being pretty amazed.
Yeah, you know, I write about how basically if you live on the island of Cyprus and you need a bone marrow transplant, you're likely to end up in Israel. I was in a Bulgarian hospital or a Japanese-owned hospital in Sofia, Bulgaria, where people with needing knee surgery from across the Middle East were coming for care. We obviously probably have heard a lot over the years about sort of wealthy foreigners coming to the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic for specialty procedures. We've probably heard about people who go to get plastic surgery in Brazil or Colombia. Almost for every procedure, there is sort of some combination of sort of supply and demand where it makes sense for people to see opportunity in another country.
You write that, I'm going to quote here, you call it a uniquely modern form of rebellion, asserting an individual's independence from the persistence of political geography. What do you mean by that? What does that mean?
So one of the sort of amazing things is, you know, we live in a day and age where money, labor, ideas move pretty freely across national boundaries. But healthcare systems are very much tied to the nation state. It's one of the few areas in the world, I think, where there's just this huge difference. You step over the border from, say, the U.S. to Canada or from France to Belgium, and you can find that you are speaking the same language. Most of the cultural signifiers are the same. In the case of France to Belgium, you're using the same currency. You're overseen by the same foreign policy, guarded by the same sort of national security edicts, same regulations when it comes to your food or drink. But how the government, insurers, providers, and patients interact in the question of who pays for health insurance is radically different. And there, even with all the talk about, you know, free trade agreements, whether it's NAFTA, multinational organizations like the European Union, nobody has really attempted to break down the ways in which these sort of healthcare regimes, regulation, insurance are sort of tied to a nation state. And so there's that presents a great opportunity for people who are willing to take the initiative to go somewhere else, because you can't import. You can import almost anything you want if you have the means around the world, except a hospital is this physical entity, and the labor that is attached to a hospital, doctors, nurses, clinicians, the equipment that they have isn't moving. Or it moves very slowly over generations. And so it becomes incumbent upon the patient to take the initiative. My first book was about the globalization of the sushi business. And, you know, part of the story there is that wealthy people around the world who wanted to eat certain types of seafood raw, starting in the 1970s, were able to pay to import it. You can't pay to import a doctor. And so you need to take the initiative to go find them if you want to use it.
So, I mean, this is kind of a different perspective and maybe one with more compassion for the patient, regardless of their means, than a previous author who maybe almost derisively referred to these tourists as patients with passports.
Yeah, I mean, what people are in a way trapped by the healthcare systems that they live in. And that's not because necessarily they're bad as policy, but every time a country sort of sets its laws about the provision of health insurance, it's privileging certain things over others. So, you know, in the United States, we historically have tried to develop a system that rewards doctors for their labor, that cultivates specialists in fields by letting them make often a lot of money doing it, that maintains a free market, that keeps tax-related costs low. In Canada, they've made a totally different set of choices. They've accepted higher taxes in exchange for universal coverage at the expense of making it a good place for certain types of specialists to apply their trade. And so that means that if you are, you know, some people benefit from each system, but if you are in Canada and you have some resources and you want an appointment with a certain type of specialist, you might have to wait, even though it would be free. And that person in a way is trapped, just like somebody in the United States who doesn't have insurance and has to pay out of pocket for a whole procedure is trapped by the fact that we don't have the provision of you know, free health insurance by the government for middle-class people. And so, you know, in both those cases, the impetus is on an individual to do this really audacious, risky, unsettling thing to go out and try to take advantage of what the global marketplace offers, even if sort of national, the decisions made nationally by politicians aren't really structured to benefit them at the time.
So for Americans leaving the U.S. for treatment, you say it's usually about the cost of care. It's a search for a bargain, which is a little counterintuitive that it's less expensive to take a foreign trip and usually an extended one, I'm guessing, and everything that entails, all of the expenses that includes, than to have surgery at home.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I we're talking about major procedures here, and this is true both in the dental stuff I write about in Hungary and medical procedures. I mean, it's rarely making sense for somebody to go fly to another continent for a checkup, for example, right? Or for a flu shot. So we're not necessarily we're almost never talking about kind of quotidian care. But you know, I cite a study. It's about a decade old now, but you know, I think the fundamental math is the same that you know an American with insurance could expect to pay $90,000 for a heart bypass surgery. An American without insurance pay $200,000 for the same procedure. In Singapore, $20,000. In Thailand, $12,000. India, $10,000. So we're talking about massive disparities in price. They get larger if you're paying out of pocket without insurance. And so even if you're flying to Bangkok and flying with a family member or two to support you and they're staying in hotels and you're paying for airfare and taxis to and from the airport
and you're
everything
missing
else.
Work.
And you're missing work, you know, if it's a difference of $190,000 in the cash you'd be paying, that, you know, it justifies itself. And so there is, you know, there's such a massive gap often between what Americans pay, especially Americans without insurance or with limited insurance for complex procedures and what they cost overseas that in those situations the economics almost always justify themselves. The question is whether, yes, you know, uprooting yourself, family members, dealing with the sort of unsettling experience of being in a country where you don't speak the language, where you're unfamiliar with sort of, you know, medical practices, whether that is something that you're willing to stomach as well.
You know, you mentioned also, though, that there are we maybe take this for granted as the reason to travel for care, but that there are other more typical motivations if you're coming from some other part of the globe.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are things like laws for assisted reproduction, right? So there's some countries that really limit in vitro fertilization. So, you know, in my reporting in Eastern Europe, I was at basically a women's health hospital that does a lot of fertility things. In Bulgaria has become a destination for, especially for people from Italy and Turkey, where for different religious reasons, there are limits on the ability of non-married couples to do IVF. And so that's a place where sort of cultural mores have affected the laws. It limits what services are available, and people are traveling there. In some cases, you know, the Cyprus example I mentioned earlier, it's a relatively small island, and there are just certain types of specialty hospitals that don't exist there. It's true in a lot of Caribbean islands, that you just have you know, whole medical specialties that just do not reside on that island. And if you want to get, you know, regardless of your ability to pay or your willingness to pay, if you want a certain type of procedure, you have to get on a plane. It just doesn't exist there.
So, part of what has made this possible is all the changes in telecommunications in the last decade or two. I mean, you can get a high-resolution image of your X-ray emailed to you, and you don't have to be sitting with your doctor to see it and talk it over. That's just one example.
Yeah, so what that has done is a lot of the sort of pre and post consultation that, you know, takes place around a major procedure can be done remotely. And maybe you travel for the procedure where the real costs are entailed, but you can get you know, an early assessment or a price quote off of a CAT scan or an X-ray that moves digitally. You know, I tell the story of Hungarian dentists who would themselves fly to London once a month to do a brief assessment, and then patients would travel to Budapest when they need the real care. Some of that stuff, if you already have X-rays or scans or medical records, those can move easily. And so it also allows for sort of, you know, one of the sort of ongoing concerns is, what if I fly halfway around the world for a surgery? I come back home weeks or months later, I realize that there are complications from it. That was one of the big barriers to people being willing to travel for care. Now, you know, it's much easier to move a medical record, you know, across continents, across time zones, across languages, and it's possible you can fly to Thailand for care, and if you get stuck needing, you know, some follow-up attention in Kansas, that your doctor there is looking at the same basis, you know, same materials as the doctor in Thailand did.
So, in Europe, I want to get to this, your focus, which is dentistry in Budapest, but this has all played out in Eastern Europe, all over Europe, but specifically in Eastern Europe in a really particular way, especially in the last couple of decades.
Yeah, so there's a sort of all these trends that are taking place that we've talked about here, sort of the lowering of borders, the ability of people to fly, to you know, move money and information quickly enough that you can handle these procedures. It's taken place in this really accelerated fashion after the fall of the Iron Curtain. And in a number of Eastern European countries, and this is really pronounced in Hungary, which is what drew me there, you have this sort of combination of, in Hungary, the legacy of Prussian medical education ensured that there were a fair number of skilled, well-trained dentists. And
Prussia
during the
is a
era,
long time ago. I'm surprised that that legacy still exists.
people credit the existence of you know, decent medical colleges from the 19th century, and education to you know, that sort of lives on. What sort of importantly across Eastern Europe is that sort of a core function of the Soviet era governments was a centralization of provision of medical services. And so, you know, there was a department in the Hungarian government during the Soviet era that ensured that every district had a certain number of dentists and doctors of different specialties, and that they were geographically distributed around the country. So you end up with this network of like fairly well-educated dentists who are networked around the country, who have been sort of insulated for a long time from market concerns. then the Iron Curtain falls, the Cold War ends, and it becomes possible for people from Germany, Switzerland, Italy, in particular Austria, to travel easily in and out of Hungary. And what they realize is that you can drive 45 minutes from Vienna and find a dentist who is charging a fraction of what your dentist in Vienna would cost. And this is true, in Slovakia as well. And so you start to get people in sort of middle Europe who realize that they're within a driving radius of much less expensive dental care. And it might not make sense again for a checkup or a cleaning to drive 2 or 3 hours from Munich to towards Budapest. But if you're getting, some oral surgery, some maxillofacial work, some bridge work, you're getting crowns put in, you're going to pay thousands of dollars, you might be willing to drive for a day and spend a night in a hotel. And so you had these border cities just over the Hungarian border that all of a sudden became destinations for foreigners who wanted to come and take advantage of the relatively high quality, relatively low price Hungarian dental work. A little bit like we think of Americans who will go to Tijuana for some basic medical or dental procedures.
There is a character in your book who is probably unknown to most of our listeners. He was unknown to me, but he's a celebrity in Hungary, I guess, the Prime Minister's dentist.
Yeah, this is a sort of great story of corruption in the new Hungary. Viktor Orban, who people may have read about, is this sort of right-wing populist who has consolidated a lot of power in Hungary. Among the sort of benefits of the cronyism of his government is his dentist, who long had his own practice in a part of Budapest where he sort of catered to a part of Budapest's elite, including then a young politician, Viktor Orban. And as Orban came to government, he started investing in, with federal funds, various projects to sort of establish dental tourism as sort of a core economic asset of Hungary, marketing it overseas, creating a sort of a consolidated website, an 800 number where people overseas could call for information, a promotional campaign, sort of packages, and with the idea that I quote somebody in the book saying, people, they think when they think of chocolates and watches, they think of Switzerland. When they think of dentistry, we want them to think of Hungary. And the great beneficiary of this turns out to be Béla Bátorfi, who is Orban's own personal dentist, but who has sort of set himself up as the kind of mogul of Hungary as a dental destination.
So this does not actually sit well with everyone in Hungary. This is a country that's been struggling to provide really basic health care to its own citizens. So the idea that serving foreigners is this success story does not, go over well, particularly in struggling rural areas.
Yeah, what you ended up getting was now, in the communist era, there's this effort to make sure that medical expertise was sort of evenly disseminated or distributed across the country. And now you see a kind of reconsolidation of dental expertise in, initially it was in the sort of border areas when the biggest influx of patients was coming by car. After Hungary joined the EU and Europe deregulated its commercial air aviation sector, people from Western Europe, Northern Europe started flying in, and you started to see this kind of clustering around, Budapest near the airport. What that means is that this is operating in a way that is sort of independent of the neighborhood family dental practice that people in the Hungarian countryside would rely on to, you know, for their kids to get basic dental work, for to get dentures for your grandma. Because it turns out to be a lot more lucrative to sort of specialize in that, in this high end of these sort of major procedures, rather than sort of the small family practice. The thing that encourages a lot of dentists in Hungary, though, to get into the sort of the tourism side of things, is that it is entirely private. There's no public insurance for dentistry. There is a national healthcare system for medical stuff, but starting in the 1990s, they basically privatized the existing dental sector. And so it's not clear to me that if you shut off or impose taxes on these high-end surgeries that are catering to foreigners, that those same dentists would necessarily start offering, you know, inexpensive cleanings for neighborhood children. I think that they're sort of, working on two different tracks at the moment.
I want
But
to
certainly
jump in. I want to jump in
it's a
here and
symbol of,
ask you if, I mean, there, you write something that I found really compelling, that it's easy to paint a caricature of the world's haves taking medicine out of the mouths of the world's have-nots. What does that miss?
Well, I think it misses that governments have sort of set the conditions for these distortions or dysfunctions in the provision of healthcare to their own citizens. And that's because nobody has figured out how to have a healthcare system that covers everybody at low or no cost, that does, encourages specialists, innovation, research, teaching. And doesn't make people wait for care.
Sasha Eisenberg is the author of Outpatients, The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism, and we will be hearing more from him later in the show. But coming up after the break, a bioethicist joins the conversation, and we'll hear how the Midwest is becoming a destination for organ transplants. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about destination medical care. Some call it medical tourism. Call 816-235-2888 if you or a family member have ever traveled for a medical procedure. Why did you do it? Take us through that decision-making process. Tell us how the experience overall maybe surprised you, whether it was good or bad, complicated, not complicated at all. We want to hear your story. 816-235-2888. Let's bring in a bioethicist. Terry Rozelle is here with us from the Center for Practical Bioethics, which is based in Kansas City. Hi, Terry.
Good morning.
So we've been hearing about medical tourism abroad. Can you bring this a little closer to home?
Well, I want to pick up, first of all, on something that Sasha just said about haves and have-nots. Because what strikes me about medical tourism as Sasha is describing it is that it is predicated mostly on socioeconomic disparities and disparities of health and health care. So
between places and between patients.
Between places primarily, but then the patients who live in those places. So it's disparity and then also availability. And so those are two different incentives for something like medical tourism. In order for medical tourism to be of interest to Americans and within the United States, we would have to have nation states with porous borders and socioeconomic systems that were as disparate as what he describes in Europe and Eastern Europe. And we don't have it quite that way, though we certainly have disparities.
Well, you know, it's interesting because he's talking about travel across international borders, and Kansas City is on a border, though obviously not an international one. Though, do we see some of what he's talking about? Because medical policy from state to state can differ.
That could drive, and does drive, patients to go from one state to another. I think it's primarily a matter of availability within the states. Something more analogous to what Sasha's writing about might be cheaper drug prices in Canada and a porous border. And so there, that incentivizes people to go to Canada and seek drugs. And my understanding is that that Congress has made that illegal to purchase and bring back pharmaceuticals from Canada that are available here. And that would be one way to try to minimize that sort of medical tourism. Another sort of medical tourism that happens from the states elsewhere would be seeking unapproved therapies for cancer, stem cell therapies, that kind of thing, in perhaps Mexico.
I want to jump back in and bring this to the more domestic thing. I mean, what I think about that I've heard about people traveling for, there are some cancer treatment centers that are just, their reputation is like, these are the best places. And that's partly, you know, when you consolidate a lot of skill and knowledge and research in one place, could there be an argument for that? Because I'm hearing a lot of argument of sort of the problems with it, such as inequality, and that's huge. But what about what you gain by consolidating resources?
There's an efficiency to that, to have specialists for cancer, but maybe especially for organ transplantation, to have centers that put together those sort of resources, which is very costly to do. To put together a transplant program is not just a few cents or a few minutes. It takes a lot of money and a lot of time. So an efficiency would be to have those in specific places, and then you have to travel to get there if you don't live in that particular city.
Well, I want to flesh out this whole organ transplant thing a little more. I mean, I understand that KU Med has a strong reputation for liver transplant surgery, but that they're kind of working to bolster that more and to become more of a destination for it?
It would be better if the transplant folk from KU Med were here to speak to that. We do have a transplant professional here in the studio who can address some of that as well. But my understanding as an ethicist is that indeed there are incentives for people from other parts of the country to come to the Midwest for shorter wait times, whether that's for a liver or for a kidney or some other organ, and that is based on need and availability. So that's a sort of medical tourism. Is that a bad thing? It becomes a question of ought and ought not, of ethics, when we think about local or regional resources like donated organs and whether they ought to be reserved primarily for that locale or if they should be made available more widely so as to make more equitable the wait times. But who can afford to come? That's another question of disparity.
Yeah, and I just want to say about the KU Med thing, it's that it is complicated, and that whether they're in a position to become that and whether they're actually like on a mission to do that, that's something that we probably can't get into too much without them. But let's look a little more closely at organ transplants in the Midwest overall. I want to bring in Sarah Oland on this. She's with us from the Midwest Transplant Network. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
So what exactly do you do? Can you explain it to me?
Yes. Midwest Transplant Network, we serve about 5.1 million people in 250 hospitals by facilitating organ donation. So that's all the hospitals in Kansas and about the western two-thirds of Missouri. So we have relationships with those hospitals. And when someone passes away, we then facilitate the donation process and make those organs available to the transplant centers for the patients that are on the national waiting list.
So who are the major players in terms of specific hospitals, in terms of states?
Well, here in our service area in Kansas and the western two-thirds of Missouri, we have five transplant facilities, and they do different organ transplants, you know, organs like hearts, lung, liver, kidney, pancreas. And then pretty much every hospital, you could potentially have someone at any of those hospitals that could become an organ or tissue donor.
So how do you come into the picture? How do you navigate all of this? And
absolutely. Yeah, it's a very complicated process. So the hospitals let us know when someone is has died, or is maybe their family is making the decision to switch to comfort measures. And at that time, we then will evaluate to see if the person who is passing away has the option to consider donation. And if they do, we will then reach out to the family and either offer them the option of donation, or maybe share with them that their loved one had signed up to be on the donor registry and had made the decision to be a donor. So we work with families at that point in time.
And so do you see that there are more organs, like more kidneys or more livers or something like that available in particular places?
Yes, there are. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services provides data that's out there that you can see what the rate of donation is for the different parts of the country. So for our geographical area that we serve, about 75% of the families who have the option of considering donations say yes, which is a very high percentage. There are 58 organizations like Midwest Transplant Network across the nation, and they all serve a particular geography. And those donation rates are available. So there may be another organ procurement organization like ours in a different part of the country where maybe 50% of the families and there say yes to donation. So we do look at that. And, you know, I think we are very lucky to be here in the Midwest, where we have an incredibly generous population that want to help their fellow man.
So does that result in a lot of people traveling to the Midwest for organ transplant surgery?
That's a great question. The transplant process is fairly separated from the donation process. So those five transplant programs that are in our area, they list individuals to be on the waiting list. And that's a national waiting list that those people get put on. I can't tell you how many people travel in because I'm not involved in the listing part. I'm involved more in the donation part of that.
So Terry Roselle, jump back in here. What can you tell me about this bigger picture as a part of the national bioethics community?
Just that we think about these things because it's not just a medical procedure. It's also a question of equity and inequity, of access or relatively less access. I raised the question about if the donor rates are higher in our region than they are on the coasts, let's say. And if the wait time for a kidney, let's say, is less here, partly as a result of that, than it is on the coasts, that incentivizes people to get listed maybe where you live, but also to get on the list in the transplant center that has a shorter waiting time.
You say partly because of that. What are the other factors?
It may be, and I'm speculating here, it may be that the incidence of disease is greater in some populations than others. There could be a lot of regional reasons beyond donation rates, but what we do know is that the wait times vary from one region to another, and that at least some people can afford to then fly to different parts of the country and get evaluated and listed in a different center than where they live. Is that a bad thing? Not necessarily, and especially not if you happen to be that patient or their family. But it does highlight disparities, and that is one thing I've noticed in reading Sasha's work as well, is medical tourism is very much predicated on disparities. It does not create, medical tourism doesn't create disparities, but it's predicated on them.
You know, I want to bring Sasha back in a second, but I'm curious about how regionalism plays into this too, because if you talk about a higher rate of organ donation in the Midwest and you think about that, quite possibly people are thinking about their friends and their neighbors. Does this question of what's ours versus who's coming and taking it, become even more pronounced with something like a life-saving organ? That's emotional.
I think so. And it's not an easy question to answer as to whether or not there should be that sort of parochialism or regionalism that says what's ours ought to stay here and not be available for others. It's very understandable to think in terms of that. And in fact, we don't have any problem at all with being more concerned about our family members than about our neighbors, or about our neighbors rather than your neighbors. That's a natural sort of sense of responsibility. How far we go with that is open for debate.
Sasha, jump back in. Sasha Eisenberg is the author of Outpatients, and that's a book about medical tourism. Sasha, what are your thoughts as you listen to this conversation about organ transplants?
Yeah, I mean, I think organ transplantation has its own ethical issues, many of which are beyond my reach. I don't think that we think about disparities in medical care, that anybody would dispute that there are huge inequities in, you know, not just globally, but within our own country, within a single metropolitan area of who has access to healthcare. It's arguably been the dominant political debate in our country over the last decade, and we've seen the difficulty of coming up with a national or state level policy that seems to satisfy all the different stakeholders that there are: providers of medical care, insurers, taxpayers, patients. And this is a political challenge, and it is a weird form of scapegoating, I think, to look at these sort of people on the margins who are trying to work around policy decisions that have been made on a national scale because they don't fit the personal needs of somebody, often, you know, at the worst moments in their lives, and to look at medical tourists or the people who offer care to medical tourists as part of the problem. I mean, I think that we need to see the political, the challenge of creating a healthy healthcare system as a political one, and understand that we have yet to see a sort of nationwide solution that will satisfy everyone, and that it'll always be something that where people are left out of the ideal solution and need to seek it out on their own.
Okay, well, we will be hearing our listeners' stories about traveling for medical care at 816-235-2888 in just a minute. Call that number with your experiences, what made you consider traveling for medical care, and whether you did it and how it went. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today's show was inspired by a book about medical tourism by Sasha Eisenberg. Hi, Sasha.
Hi.
Tell us again what your definition of medical tourism is.
Patients crossing international borders in search of care.
And then, of course, it happens across state lines, too, here within the United States, a little different. But we're joined by Terry Rozelle of the Center for Practical Bioethics and Sarah Oland of the Midwest Transplant Network. Hi, guys.
Good morning.
And Sarah, you're here partly because one of the big reasons why people cross state borders is for organ transplants. Can you talk about, you were just saying over the break that there are certain kinds of transplants that you can't get in certain places.
Yeah. If, for example, if you live in Kansas and you are in need of a lung transplant, there are no transplant centers in the state of Kansas that do lung transplants. So you will need to go.
Like you have to.
You have to. There is no way to get a lung transplant in a hospital in Kansas. So your insurance companies typically will drive you to a center of excellence that does the lung transplant programs, but it will not be in Kansas because there are none.
So a center of excellence, what is that?
It's kind of what we were talking about that Terry had mentioned, where you have a center that has all the specialists and has devoted a lot of resources and time to expertise and education on a certain type of transplant.
Well, if you want to get in on this conversation, you can call 816-235-2888 with your experiences about traveling for medical care or considering it and what those reasons were. Terry, tell me more about like what you hear in the ethics of something like what Sarah is describing, the ethical concerns and considerations.
Well, it's predicated on availability. And so I don't see any ethical problem per se with traveling across state lines to find medical care that isn't available where you live. There's one could hope that there were basic health care resources available for everyone, and there isn't. When it's specialty care, of course you may have to travel. Another sort of analogy to what Sasha writes about relative to availability and having to travel would be legality. So there are some states where medically assisted dying is legal, and many other states like ours where it's not legal. So if one wanted to have medically assisted dying in something like Oregon or Washington's system, one would have to travel. Or marijuana is legalized in some states and not others, and therefore people have traveled, sort of medical tourism.
You know, we've been talking mostly about sort of costs, I guess. And I'm curious about whether the question, I mean, when I asked about ethics, you mentioned, well, there would be nothing unethical about crossing the border. And I had not been thinking of the ethics of the traveler or the patient. I had been thinking more the ethics of the larger system that makes that feel necessary to begin with.
And I agree with Sasha entirely that this is primarily, when it's grounded in disparities especially, or lack of availability of something that should be available in a particular locality and it's not, that's a systemic issue. It's governments that should be addressing that. I think there are ethical obligations that come to bear on individual patients as well, and I ought to be interested in what I access as how that impacts other people. So there is a sense in which narcissism can be created or exacerbated if I need something and some other locality has that resources, and it's a scarce resource, and I travel there to get it regardless.
That could be problematic. A scarce resource like a kidney?
Like a kidney.
Absolutely. I was just thinking, you know, the waiting list and how people are matched with organ donors is blinded in terms of, you know, fairness. I mean, they have really gone out of their way to figure out the most fair way to get the people who are the sickest, who've been waiting the longest, the organs. But it is a scarce resource, and it is geographical because organs can only be out of the body for a certain amount of time. But the waiting list is generated to be as fair as possible. But then you have people who put up billboards, or if anybody's seen someone with a sign that says, "My husband needs a kidney, call this phone number." There are personal ways that people who need something that is very scarce try to maneuver what is set out to be as fair and equitable as possible.
I want to come right back. Oh, sorry. Go on, Sasha.
Can I hop in? I was talking a little earlier about how sort of the costs of are determined by insurance and regulations. A whole set of regulations that makes medical care in the United States more expensive than anywhere else on earth also have to, are designed to enforce the quality of care around licensure, around compliance. This is part of the reason the pharmaceuticals are more expensive here. Testing. I do think we should be afraid from an ethical perspective, from a legal perspective, from a political perspective, about a kind of race to the bottom as national boundaries become less important and even state boundaries become less important, that people will rush to countries that have fewer safeguards for the provision of care, because along with that comes lower costs, and that then motivates countries like, say, Hungary, that want to market themselves as destinations for dental or medical tourism, to sort of deregulate their patient protections in a way that hurts the local population as well.
Let's talk to one of our callers. We've got Justin calling us. Justin, what do you want to share?
I wanted to share before I didn't travel for medical care, but when my wife and I first got married, and before Obamacare existed, we always had the plan that if we got accidentally pregnant, we would fly to India to have the baby, because we couldn't afford to do it here.
Because of hospital costs? And maybe it sounds like perhaps you were uninsured?
Yes, we were uninsured and hospital costs, and my wife's family is from India, and its care is just as good, but it costs tens of thousands of dollars less.
And this is not an extreme kind of procedure. This is having a baby. Sasha Eisenberg, can you talk to me about this?
Yeah, this is not atypical. The types of procedures that make sense for medical tourism are sort of big, expensive, one-time, procedures that are can be scheduled in advance, and that usually have enough of a buffer around them that you can travel and convalesce as necessary at the point of the procedure. And, assuming your baby arrives on schedule, pregnancy kind of fits that mold. It makes a lot of sense that people would sort of look for opportunities there. And India is a country that we see huge growth, including a lot of foreign investment trying to develop hospital chains, some of them branded. They're Swiss hospital chains that are moving into India with eyes not just on the sort of rising Indian middle class and elite, but drawing patients from overseas.
One of the surprising details from your book, Sasha, is that people in Oman have a high incidence of needing knee replacements, and that there are a lot of knees to be replaced in Bulgaria, and that this is like a really common route to travel. I was really fascinated both by what was motivating that for the people of Oman and how Bulgaria became the place to go.
Yeah, so in Oman's, in this case, emblematic of a number of Middle Eastern countries where there's a lot of stress on knees because of prayer.
The repetitive movement of genuflecting.
Repetitive movement of genuflecting. And what social scientists call belated motorization leads to a lot of car crashes. So you have a lot of countries that were relatively late in the 20th century to have large-scale reliance on individual cars. You have a lot of car accidents. You put all that together, you're getting a lot of people with injuries. One of the big and around the wealthy countries of the Gulf, a lot of the governments are providing fairly expansive healthcare coverage to their citizens. They're wealthy countries. They are basically signing wholesale contracts with other countries to send their citizens overseas, paying the full freight because it is less expensive for the United Arab Emirates to basically send people who need organ transplants to South Korea than it is to quickly build up the necessary expertise and facilities to do it themselves. I noted the great irony that Dubai had the tallest building in the world before it had a single organ transplant hospital. So the sort of pace of development in medicine can very rarely catch up with the pace of development in other sectors.
But it's interesting to me, and I want to kick this to you, Sarah, that we were talking earlier about insurance companies sending people within the United States mm-hmm. to places of excellence when their own states do not have one. Or in the case of Kansas, we just don't even have any place to get a lung transplant. That's interesting to me that on a smaller scale, on a domestic scale, it's kind of the same model.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, we would love to have, you know, a transplant center here, but it takes an investment of time and expertise to do that. So,
well, our time is up. Thank you so much, Sarah Olin, Director of Family and Hospital Services for the Midwest Transplant Network.
Thank you.
And Terry Rozelle of the Center of Practical Bioethics. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sasha Eisenberg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sasha is the author of Outpatients, The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. You can share this interview with anyone who might have missed it. Just go to our show archives later today and we'll have it ready for you. KCUR.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow we'll have some StoryCorps conversations to play as the Airstream trailer wheels into town. This episode of Central Standard was produced by Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.